Thank you very much, Professor Ronke, for this very exciting overview covering both past, present and the future. May I invite you to be part of the panel and also the other speakers to come up to the podium where we can answer any questions. I'll receive the questions in paper form, I think, in soon, but meantime, actually, you can also invite you to go to the microphones. And waiting for that, actually, I would like to ask the first question to Professor Ronke. Professor Ronke, you have covered, let's say, a lot of technologies, and, but there's also developments on cell-based therapies. How do you think, actually, that cell-based therapies would fit into the spectrum, actually, which you have been discussing? Is there any future for that?
Well, we may look very carefully to this, because I think this is the future. Where you're talking mostly about regenerative medicine. I don't think in my life I will ever see cell therapy to be applied for regeneration of kidney tissue, nevertheless. You know, the promises of stem cells and the idea to repopulate a renal scaffold with new cells is very interesting. However, I think that this is still premature for the moment. When we try to integrate cells with, let's say, artificial organs like the renal assist device and so on, we failed to find the specific benefits for one reason. I think that while you can standardize a dialysis membrane and make kilometers with the same characteristics, when you introduce a biological component, the possibility of standardization is much, much lower. We reached some standardization, for example, with the biological drugs. So in the future, we might be able to do that, but not in this moment, I think.
And if you're looking at the smart membranes, for instance, would you foresee actually selective kind of membranes which could target very specifically substances actually which are would play a role in pathogenesis or maintenance of organ failure?
You know, it's interesting because in the oncology world, for example, they have already developed specific membranes that are able to deliver drugs at the given rate and with specific molecular weight. In nephrology, one of the main problems is that we are not able to ask specific questions to the engineers. When the engineers come to us and said, how would you like to functionalize the membrane? How would you like to design a smart membrane? We don't know. We don't even know what uremia is yet. So I think that we need to better study the human kidney in order to understand what we want to mimic. Yes, we may say that uremia or acute uremia at the end is a water and salt intoxication, but it's more than that. And studies for molecules and the middle molecule of the year and now free light chain or pro-inflammatory mediators all describe a situation of imbalance in the blood, and we want definitely to get rid of these molecules. However, it's just that we need more than one membrane that remove one molecule or the other molecule. We need something that probably achieve what we call homeostasis, the correction of the internal milieu. We go back to Claude Bernard, and possibly immunohomeostasis, which is the most important thing, especially in sepsis.
Thank you very much. Did you already receive also some questions?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Could you?
So the first question is from the audience. Why is the time between AV fistula creation and first cannulation in the U.S. longer than that of Japan and Italy? Well,
you're only Italian.
Yeah. Maybe they're better surgeons. No, I think one of these, that's a very good question. So when you talk about time to cannulation, if you're using a fistula, we'd like to give it ordinarily 4 to 6 weeks. We bring the patient back sooner than that, ultrasound them, and if it looks like it's maturing adequately, we'll go ahead and use it. The fistula first initiative, I've noticed in my own experience, I think is sort of encouraging us to use veins in the past we may not have used, and trying to do some techniques with these veins which do require a longer maturation period. So one thing you may be seeing in your practice is the fistula first initiative is encouraging people to use venous conduit that in the past we might have just gone to a graft sooner with earlier cannulation. So that may be one thing. It's delayed our, we want to give it more time for maturation, maybe try that BAM technique that we talked about, the balloon maturation. So it probably has extended, we're using more veins, but it's probably extended the amount of time we have to wait for maturation in many cases. With grafts, you could cannulate a graft immediately, especially with some of these new, I think, more refined and better constructed early cannulation grafts. If possible, we would like to wait a little time just so that we don't get the complications of needle removal when it's initially cannulated. But with good care, under ultrasound guidance, you could cannulate a graft the next day.
Okay. Do you have any other questions before you?
Oh, sure. I'll keep on.
Can I add something?
Oh, yes, sir. Please.
I think because it was made the reference to Italy. In Italy, there was a specific tradition that the AV fistula was made by the nephrologist, not by the surgeon. Now, this is the same as planting a PD catheter. It was the nephrologist, not the surgeon. Again, for a surgeon, a PD catheter is a cannula in the abdomen. For a nephrologist, the PD catheter is saving life of the patient. So I think that the fistula question is always the same. We tend to be more careful in preserving the forearm vessels, to use the more distal approach possible. And we know very well that even if the vein is very, very tiny, if the artery is okay, doesn't matter. It will develop. While the surgeon tends to say, oh, this is too small, let's go, and we lose part of the arm for this.
Yeah, I would also say that if you have a good relationship with your dialysis units, you're more prone to allow the techs to go ahead and cannulate early. You know, unfortunately, so many times I think we have a great fistula, and I say, okay, go ahead and use it, and it comes back. Just had one the other day. It comes back bleeding and bruising, and someone just wasn't really good at cannulating. So I think if you have developed, and we are now working with a new company called Somatus, who is coming online, and they've asked me to actually help them, and we're going to really visit the dialysis centers and help maybe do some training or some education of the techs. I think that's a big thing. And then my final comment on this issue is I'm a huge bicycle rider, and my bicycle is the Italian Pinarello, and the Italians are, no matter what, they are the best at merging form and beauty and function. So I think that must have something to do with it.
But is the remote monitoring device that you have said, it's available, or?
Well, it's yes. So we finished our first-in-man clinical trial in the U.S., and it's going to be beginning our European trial soon, if you'd love to participate. We're starting. There's already some centers in England and Germany who are enrolling. So we would love to have you.
Very interesting.
Yes, sir.
I was actually fascinated by that, but you get a massive amount of data, actually.
Yeah.
How are you going to handle this in clinical practice, also in terms of accountability?
That's a great question. And when we first were working with this in the lab, that was one of the major topics of discussion. You can generate huge volumes of data, I mean, second by second. So you really have to define, and the company has started to come up with algorithms so that you get the information that's appropriate. And how is that information acted upon? So that could be a medical legal issue. Let's say something's sent that doesn't make it where it needs to be. So all these issues about how the data is going to be accumulated and transmitted is being addressed. Great question.
But you can use a sniffer, no?
Pardon, sir?
You can use a kind of a sniffer, an alarm.
Yes, pressure. Oh, absolutely, yes. So, this data will go from the fistula through the cloud to your computer, and we can set it to have it tell you or your nurse practitioner whenever you want.
Roberto, can you take the next question, please?
Yeah. One question is what daily salt intake is appropriate for CKD patients, and just looking at the balance between what would be appropriate in terms of blood pressure reduction as an outcome and also what's included in the trials for renal protection. Most of the trials will try something like 5 grams a day of salt or 3 grams a day of sodium. And I think this is feasible in many countries. But, of course, this will be individualized to get compliance of patients. And, of course, something else that should be discussed is that some CKD patients that would have particular conditions might have different targets. So a bit of individualization is necessary there.
Okay, and to follow up on this, actually, you focused really on hypertension. That's also how we were brought up, actually, I think, in clinical practice. But if you look at the observational data, actually, the main risk, especially in dialysis patients, but I also look at your slides on the NDT paper, even in younger patients, is in patients who have spontaneously low systolic blood pressures, let's say below 120, 110. And actually moving to new guidelines where you actually actively are going to bring your systolic blood pressure under the 120 would move them in this dangerous range. Do you think there's a difference between actually having a spontaneous low blood pressure as a risk factor or bringing patients actively who have higher blood pressures into this range? Because in the end, it's the same blood pressure, but maybe different kind of patients. And how can you differentiate between these?
Yeah, and I think the guideline work group should really focus on the trials, and therefore you're talking about hypertensive patients who would be targeted to a reduction in blood pressure. But I think you're right. I think the recommendation on what to do with the spontaneous blood pressure, it's something that should be there in the document to guide people, because my feeling is that this is going to be a very different situation when you're talking about spontaneous blood pressure and targets. That influences also the question of when do you initiate treatment. So I think the group would address all three things, and I have a feeling that this is all going to be in the document to guide clinicians.
Before moving back to Dr. Neville, I would like to ask Dr. Ronco actually about, let's say, the use of hepatic support therapy, because it has actually not received a great penetrance until now in ICU, whereas you also will likely have in many ICU patients at least subclinical, we don't know if it's subclinical, amount of hepatic toxins actually, and we do not remove them. And do you think that at this moment hepatic support therapy is actually underutilized, or what would be your view on that?
First of all, let me try to be very honest, and I think that the hepatorenal patients are the worst patient we see, and they tend to have bad outcomes in general. I just want to show that we don't have the magic stick. So especially for those who begin to do this, they must be aware that even in the most advanced centers, the outcomes are not so satisfactory. The other thing is that these therapies, whether you use the MARS or the Prometheus, which are a combination of plasma filtration, use of sorbents, albumin dialysis, and so on, seems to provide some sort of support, but a very limited capacity of support. Even hemoperfusion for the removal of bilirubin is very limited in the capacity unless you change very frequently the sorbent and so on. So I think, yes, they are probably a little underutilized, especially for the subclinical forms, trying to avoid to evolve into more severe forms. But nevertheless, they are probably not used too much because the results are not so satisfactory. And we have probably to start thinking and probably redesign a little bit. But before redesigning the system, once again, we need to know exactly what we want from the system. What are the solutes we want to remove? What is the kinetics of these solutes? And I think that there is a very interesting example. Recently, we had a chronic intoxication in a large population in Italy for perfluoralkylic substances that we don't even know if they are dangerous or not, but hopefully you don't want them in blood and in tissues. And they have tried to use plasmapheresis with some interesting results, but limited effect at the end. The same is true for liver support. It is underutilized because we have no specific targets, and there is very little research done in this area.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Neville, could you read us the next question, please?
Many good questions. The next one is regarding the buttonhole technique for dialysis access. What are thoughts about cannulation of this buttonhole technique, and have we seen complications with it? So the buttonhole technique is a single access point which is used consistently. And when it first came out, it sort of was perplexing to me because we had always thought we should avoid doing that to avoid destruction of the fistula or the graft and pseudoaneurysms and infections. And interestingly, we didn't see that. We didn't see a lot more pseudoaneurysms or infections with this buttonhole technique. There did seem to be some thromboses that occurred that I thought were wouldn't have with the other technique. And it's also interesting, it seems to have sort of fallen a little bit into some disfavor. I don't see as many of them as we used to see them when they first came out. So I don't know if you've noticed in your units, noticed some issues or difficulties with the buttonhole technique. I'd love to hear that. It seems that there was a surge of them, and now they've sort of dropped off a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. We have the same experience indeed. And a little bit more, the fear of bacteremia actually has emerged. Excellent. Although maybe, what do you think of, let's say, very dedicated protocols? There have been some reports that the use of very dedicated protocols could actually circumvent these bacteremic events. Have you any experience with that?
We didn't see many. I mean, it really didn't seem to increase the incidence of, in our personal experience with pseudoaneurysms or bacteremias, but there did seem to be some technical issues, and they did seem to have fallen into some disfavor, seemingly.
In the past, we had these subcutaneous devices, actually, which also fell out of favor. But now we have new materials, maybe, and better bactericidal surfaces. Would you foresee actually a revival of these techniques?
That's a great point. Yeah, you could. You know, it's interesting, and when we've looked at the graft literature, so bypass graft literature, adherence of antibiotic to the surface didn't really seem to impact graft infections. It was more good technique, meticulous technique, no other wounds on the leg, and handling of the graft appropriately intraoperative. So binding of antibiotics solutions and antibiotic irrigations didn't seem to help much with bypass grafts. But with these subcutaneous devices, which are cannulated obviously much more frequently, we don't cannulate bypass grafts, that really would be, I think, a great step forward.
You know, it's interesting that I would like to quote a sentence that Beldin Scribner told me once. He said, Claudio, we have to reanalyze every 5 years our projects, especially those who failed, because with the new materials, with the new devices, with the new knowledge, we might succeed when we failed before. And he was meaning this about continuous arterial venous hemofiltration, because he said we always wanted to do this, but we didn't have the filters to do this.
That's a great point. And going back to Roberto Picquart, do you have other questions actually in front of you?
Yeah, there's a question about orthostatic hypotension in elderly patients, what the discussion was all about. And I think it was a very important discussion during the meeting, and the feeling that especially the elderly population, when you try to reach the targets that might be recommended by the new guidelines in the general population and perhaps in CKD, you might actually end up with a group of patients who would be prone to orthostatic hypotension, and that might, you know, lead to falls and things like that. So this is the current knowledge favors this type of thought, that you would be, if you're more strict on targets, you get more complications in the elderly. That goes against the findings of SPRINT, actually, that did not see a lot of very different results in terms of side effects, including falls in the elderly population when you try to reach more lower targets. So I think after the careful review of the literature, we might be surprised about the safety of lower targets in the elderly population, although there should be a caution there in recommendations, because for some patients you really need to individualize, and I think that's how the recommendation is going to be, individualization of the elderly or the treatment of elderly patients, being careful for them.
Okay, thank you. For Dr. Ronco, I have a personal question. If you also talked about sensors and monitoring, especially with regard to fluid state, and we know that actually fluid overload is a major risk factor for mortality in these patients. But for instance, if I do a consultation in the ICU, you see usually on forehand that at least from an interstitial point of view, they're nearly always fluid overloaded. What would actually your advice be? I always have the feeling that we should actually probably, your tolerance is more due to the filling of the intravascular compartment. Do we have any reliable ways, maybe apart from, let's say, vena cava echography as a kind of a substitute, to measure the tolerance to fluid removal? Because usually we know that the fluid is there, but if you want to remove it, you end up in increasing vasopressors, having to stop ultrafiltration. It's a severe clinical dilemma. What would be your view on that?
Well, first of all, I must say that we recently carried out and published a paper called Do-Re-Mi-Fa, which is a dose response analysis and fluid overload analysis in several ICU use on more than 700 patients, and we found that they are all fluid overload, then they tend to die more when they are more fluid overload. However, they are much less fluid overloaded compared to 10 years ago. So there is much more attention in the ICU to the fluid infusion. I think they have now devices like the FlowTrack, the Pico, the different system capable to see how much the patient is fluid responsive, for example, in case of a real dehydration of intravascular depletion, rather than giving fluid in septic patient no matter what. Mm-hmm. So I think we are moving towards a much more specific and careful analysis of the U-shaped curve, which shows high incidence of complication if the patient has a liberal fluid intake, but also high level of complication if the patient is dehydrated. So this is a very, very important thing. From our point of view, I think that they have always been careful to the response of fluid infusion in terms of cardiac output and so on. We are much more interested in terms of patient response when we try to remove the fluid. And therefore, I don't know why, for example, bioimpedance has not been more utilized in the ICU. I wonder why the blood volume management in the extracorporeal circuit is not utilized in acute machines. I think that this should be improvement that should be done.
As a kind of a continuous measurement of both interstitial extracellular volume by bioimpedance and blood volume changes during...
But I have a question for you or for whoever wants to answer. Don't you have the impression that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we all knew the people in the R&D departments of the companies and we had a direct contact with them, and now this has been partially lost? In other words, companies tend to develop things, but the interaction with the clinician on the floor and is a little bit lost. And I think this is losing a lot of professional information and a lot of knowledge in the field. The companies tend to purchase devices who have been developed and validated for a mountain of millions of dollars, but they do not fund the specific research for small projects and so on. Why do you think is this occurring? Do you have the same impression?
To some degree, there is still interaction, I think, actually. Especially, I think, for the very nice example was actually by Richard Neville, actually, regarding this. I think it's not a major company, actually, but regarding the new sensor approach. So there are certainly startups which are very interested in interacting, and also, let's say, I think also the larger companies, but it's probably a little bit more difficult than it used to be. But I would be interested also in the experience.
But that is an excellent point. And Dr. Ronco has made two excellent points. To the trainees in the audience, his first comment about revisiting your work every 5 years, unbelievably important. I wish I had someone tell me that when I first began. I was working at the NIH in the cardiology lab. We were doing initial work on intravascular ultrasound and atherectomy devices and laser angioplasty. None of them really worked very well, so I put it all away, and now it's all the rage. Every 5 years, that's a great rule. I wish I had heard that sooner. In terms of relationships with industry, a huge problem in this country. So I'm on the scientific advisory board of four or five companies, uncompensated mostly. But it's a huge problem because the government has put such restrictions on our ability to interact with the companies now that it has really, I think, impeded our ability to give them feedback. And the companies realize this. I think the companies are also struggling with this mightily because you're exactly right. They have these very talented engineers and very talented scientists who desperately need some clinical input. We've actually started a clinical externship for some of the companies where they will send their engineers and scientists to spend a couple days with us on peripheral disease, and we actually did one on dialysis. You'd be amazed how many of these people who were developing the techniques and the technology have never seen an artery, have never seen a vein, have never seen a plaque. So we desperately need to figure this out because I think it is really impeding in the United States our ability to keep up and with the development. Great point.
Any other questions, actually, which you have in front of you? No? Not at all. Do you have any other questions in front of you?
Oh, yes.
The
yeah? I was on a roll.
Yeah, you're on a roll, okay.
Yeah. Yes, there's a question on upper extremity access and lower extremity access. Why would you really push the envelope with upper extremity before going to the lower extremity? I'm actually an advocate of lower extremity. Some of my happiest patients have lower extremity grafts and fistulas. In my world, though, the other surgeons, we are pretty loath to do that because of infection. The groin is just, it's a tough place. You get lymphoceles, seromas. The groin, matter of fact, Michael DeBakey, the famous surgeon in Texas, the famous heart surgeon, I heard him give a talk one time. He gave grand rounds before he passed. He said the one part of the operation he always did was the groin dissection. He let the residents do everything else, working on the aorta and the heart, but he always did the groin dissection. Because the groin is just, it's a tough spot. There's lots of things there. You have to be very careful and meticulous. So it's a little tougher to deal with, higher infection. You can get arterial steel. All our patients have PAD in their legs. They just do. So you should start checking that in your units, too. So if you're going to now put something in that's going to take blood away from the leg, there's not a small, unless you're careful, there's an instance of steel. So infection, steel, and then swelling. They can get some leg swelling from the fistula. So I actually like lower extremity grafts and fistulas, but most people are loath to put them in.
And to follow up on this, actually, we have the Fistula First initiative, but we also have an increased number of elderly patients who also might have severe cardiac failure, and sometimes you don't have the opportunities to have a lower arm vascular access, and you need to go to the upper arm. Which would actually be your advice in patients with cardiac failure or cardiac compromise? Do you actually have any limits saying, okay, I'm not going to do an upper arm fistula in this patient because of the potential cardiac consequences and rather go to prosthesis, to lower arm prosthesis?
No, that's a great point as well. So in patients who have congestive heart failure and myocardial dysfunction, first of all, our sensor will be very helpful because it will give us very good data on their blood volume and we can help control that. But, you know, there really hasn't been a huge increase in the exacerbation of congestive heart failure with the upper extremity fistulas and grafts. We try to stay as far down on the arm to avoid that, but it's usually a chronic situation. They usually develop this after the fistula and graft's been in chronically.
But if I may say, there is a lot of, understatement of the importance of diastolic dysfunction in our patients. Most of the times, people tend to look at the ejection fraction, at the performance of the left ventricular activity without really looking into myocardial stiffness, which is something very common in our patients. So we are, in Italy, you know, we have always been advocates of fistulas, and we had very, very limited number of catheters. Now, in elderly patients, when we document, especially diastolic dysfunction and so on, sometimes we use electively the catheter rather than the fistula in order to avoid the precipitation of a condition.
That's a great point. I had a patient in my office just the other day with a catheter, and they wanted me, and I said, for that exact reason, I said, no, ma'am, you stay with the catheter.
Okay, thank you very much. We have to wrap up because it's lunchtime at this moment. Time is flying. I would like to thank the audience for all the questions and the panel members for an exciting discussion, and I wish you all a good lunch.
Thank you very much. Thank you.